From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. This program is made possible in great part by the generous support of you, our listeners. Many of you have been with us almost from the beginning and some from the beginning. We're very thankful for your support and your interest in this kind of radio. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, Sundown Sunday brings the start of the Jewish observance of Sukkot, the Feast of Tabernacles. And Thursday is the Sikh commemoration of the installation of scriptures as Guru Granth, as well as the Baha'i celebration of the birth of the Bab. Now, at the intersection of religion, government, and politics this week, a new poll from the Atlantic Magazine and the Public Religion Research Institute offers the strongest evidence yet that male and female voters are divided over Donald Trump in a way we've never seen. In fact, if the election were held today with only male voters, Trump would be the overwhelming winner. But restrict the vote to only women, and Hillary Clinton would win by a margin that would eclipse that of Ronald Reagan. Edie Windsor, the 87-year-old lesbian widow who was the plaintiff in a case that reached the Supreme Court and led to the ruling opening up marriage equality nationwide, is a bride again. Edie's relentless LGBT activism brought her into contact with Judith Kaysen, a 51-year-old financial advisor who patiently wooed Windsor until she couldn't say no. Edie and Judith wed at New York City Hall on September 26th. And happy anniversary to our friends at People for the American Way, the group's essential website, rightwingwatch.org, is celebrating 10 years of relentless reporting on fringe and not-so-fringe religious political right activity. Again and again, they expose things done and words spoken that would otherwise have remained in the shadows. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
If I win, I am going to instruct my Attorney General to get a special prosecutor to look into your situation.
It's just awfully good that someone with the temperament of Donald Trump is not in charge of the law in our country.
Because you'd be in jail.
They said it couldn't be done. But at the second presidential debate, GOP candidate Donald Trump proved that it was possible to hit yet another new low in this year's campaign by vowing to imprison his opponent were he to win the election next month. And that wasn't the only memorable thing that came out of St. Louis. On this week's show, we'll take the pulse of the race for the White House with political management expert Greg LaBelle.
This person, whatever you think about her, she's in this historic role as the first woman to get this close to the American presidency. And she's having to wrestle this troll, right? She's working through the muck of misogyny.
Much as we'd love to give Trump a rest, we're compelled to get the insightful perspective of New York Magazine writer Rebecca Treister, who has spoken out compellingly on the gender issues on display last Sunday night in St. Louis. But first,
we have many evangelical women. One evangelical woman said to me, how are we going to expect our young girls and women to come forward when they see Christian leaders on television saying, well, these are just words. It's just locker room talk.
The decade-old recording of a majority party presidential candidate lewdly describing the license to engage in sexual assault that he thinks his fame grants him was shocking enough. But in the aftermath of the tape's release, even more shocking has been the dexterity with which political and religious right leaders have managed to dismiss those remarks. For those of us who are skeptical of the religious aspect of the religious right, that may be less surprising. But what about the followers of those leaders, particularly evangelical women? For a look at this painful issue, I'm pleased to be joined by the Reverend Jennifer Crumpton, author of the book Femme Evangelical. Jenny, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Thanks so much for having me, Reverend Gaddy, and thank you for talking about this important issue.
I've been reading this week about several prominent women evangelical leaders expressing hurt and disappointment that their male counterparts have found ways to excuse Donald Trump's outrageous statements. I'm really eager to hear your take on this.
First of all, let me start by saying that if this is locker room talk that Trump was doing, then we should be closing down every locker room in the country right about now. Actually, a lot of athletes have come out and said, this is actually not what happens in locker rooms. And Trump calling this locker room talk is actually very offensive to us.
Of course.
I'm really happy that a lot of prominent evangelical women have been coming out and standing up to their counterparts, Ralph Reed, so many others who are extremely influential conservative evangelicals coming out and saying, you know, it's our duty to vote for Trump. This was just talk. This was a long time ago. And, you know, technically they condemn what Trump said, but then they go on to support Trump fully and wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. And at Liberty University, President Jerry Falwell Jr. actually told the students, look, it's your duty to vote for Trump. So I think what so many evangelical women are extremely upset about is that once again, women's lives and our safety and our well-being get completely swept under the rug. Mm-hmm. There's some talk, there's statements about condemning what Trump said, no women should be talked about this way, et cetera. But then when it ultimately comes down to it, when push comes to shove, they're still going to completely support Donald Trump, even though he clearly stated in unequivocal terms, self-confessed, he's a sexual predator. Mm-hmm. Because really, Trump's remarks, if you look at them closely, they're not just words. He's actually talking about actions, specific actions he took toward and against women. The fact that he was newly married, that's a twist to it as well, that you would think that a lot of evangelicals would be upset about, because that's often a big issue that they stand behind is family and fidelity, et cetera. But the real issue is that Donald Trump was promoting and has confessed to be engaging in sexual assault in the past. So, you know, what leaders like Ralph Reed and Jerry Falwell Jr. are doing is basically, particularly in the case of Liberty University, telling young men that it's absolutely fine to sexually assault women. That's the message that they're promoting. And that young women, you just might as well go ahead and expect it, because even the most powerful men in the world are going to do it as well, and we're going to just let it slide.
Jenny, is it fair to say that this is actually a visible expression of a tension that's been simmering for a long, long time in many evangelical circles?
Oh, yeah. I think that's really well said, Reverend Gaddy. Absolutely. And I write about this in my book, Femme Evangelical, The Modern Girl's Guide to the Good News, because in my mind, this goes all the way back to the development of Christian theology. And it it's also a product of American Christian doctrinal changes, particularly with the moral majority, where getting a Republican into the White House or into Congress or whatever may be the case is much more important than the actual lives of women or any vulnerable minority within our country, for that matter. Mm-hmm. But particularly with women, you know, I actually have a piece that's going to come out in Time later this week. And in it, I talk about the fact that ignoring and dismissing such violence, it's actually, to me, one of the consequences of this implicit conservative Christian belief that women were created secondarily by God.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that is sort of a tenet of doctrine and Christian theology that is taken from Genesis and interpreted in a certain way that gives men God-given authority over women, women's bodies, creation, children, dominion over everything. And I really believe that this is one of the reasons our society still does not take sexual assault seriously, is because we're truly still not looked at as equals when it comes to evangelical conservative circles. And I don't want to lump all evangelicals into that, because certainly not all self-professed evangelicals believe that. But when it comes to this conservative group that's supporting Donald Trump, that's very much a big part of their history, not allowing women to have certain roles within the church and only allowing us to have certain roles within society, making decisions for us about our bodies and our reproductive health and our well-being without consulting us. Ultimately, what we want to see is action. We want to see definitive action that proves that the freedom and equality of women is just as important as ISIS or the economy or abortion in particular is a very offensive part of what Ralph Reed was talking about. He said, we have a duty to vote for Trump because he's the anti-abortion ticket, pandering to this community, saying he will repeal Roe versus Wade, he'll appoint Supreme Court justices that will tear it down. You know, it's very interesting that abortion was the number one issue that Ralph Reed brought up as to why people should be voting for Donald Trump, when Donald Trump is somebody who is a sexual predator who destroys women's lives.
Jenny, I can't understand these men not seeing that what they're doing to win a political election is down the way going to compromise the way women experience Christian worship, Christian faith, the kind of morality that a Christian man has, when women are being swept aside or worse, abused by this? Or am I just wrong about that?
Oh, no, I think you're absolutely right. This is something that goes way back, because, you know, Pew polls and various studies have shown over the past few years that women have been leaving the church in droves.
Mm-hmm.
The numbers of women committed to the Christian church or the evangelical church, but even more broadly, just the Christian church, has been dwindling very quickly, especially among young women. And it's because younger women just aren't willing to take this anymore. They see it as extremely hypocritical. They see the political loyalties as extremely damaging, and they aren't able to trust the church. The other night on CNN, conservative commentator Kayleigh McEnany was arguing on behalf of Trump that she didn't see anybody as irredeemable because everyone's forgiven in Jesus Christ. And therefore, the American people should forgive Trump of this sin and continue to support him. And what she's doing is actually supporting what has been one of the major downfalls of the Christian church in my eyes, which is to put politics first, particularly in just the last few decades, sweep things like this under the rug, and allow abuse to continue unmitigated, because they aren't going to challenge powerful men who can sway the political framework in the direction they want to go it, which has been Republican. What she doesn't say in that statement is that forgiveness, I think the Christian church has had a lot of problem with what the outcome of forgiveness should actually be. forgiving Trump for saying this or doing this or whatever. I mean, that's everybody's prerogative on their own timeline and depth of thought around the issues. But believing that Christian forgiveness means that you have to still have a duty to vote for Trump, naively and foolishly putting him into the highest office in the world, that has just led to continued unmitigated abuse for decades, if not centuries. Mm-hmm. So I do think this absolutely affects women and girls, how we feel when we walk into a church, the level of trust that we have for our religious faith, mm-hmm. and, you know, whether it serves us well. You know, we're so often taught, you're here to serve the church, you're here to serve God, it's not about you. You know, there's a lot of Christian tenets about self-sacrifice that really apply to women only mm-hmm. in a lot of ways or has been applied that way. And so oftentimes women who have been raised in the church, we're made to feel, and I will say this is absolutely my experience personally, we're made to feel like we're just supposed to allow it mm-hmm. because this is the church talking. These are the leaders who represent Jesus Christ on earth talking, and they must know what's right, and we're supposed to just sort of grin and bear it and endure it and not say a whole lot about it. Mm-hmm. But that's just not really cutting it anymore with women. And I think the more that we're gaining our voices in society at large, the mm-hmm. more we're unwilling to accept this kind of stuff from our faith tradition.
Jennifer D. Crumpton is the author of Femevangelical, The Modern Girl's Guide to the Good News. She earned a Master of Divinity from Union Theological Seminary, and she was ordained by Park Avenue Christian Church in New York City. Jennifer, it's always great to talk with you, but today especially because we needed to hear your voice, your faith-based voice about something that has gripped our nation. And so thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you, Reverend Gaddy. It's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
With just a few weeks to go till Election Day, it's time to get an expert take on the state of the race. And with me once again is Greg LaBelle, Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University. Greg is also the veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg, the last time we spoke, it felt safe to assume that things had gotten as bad as they could get with this election. They've gotten even worse, and God knows what's coming next. Thanks for being with us again.
Welton, you're right. We can't even imagine where the bottom is in this election. It's been one awful thing after another, and yeah, who knows where this is going to end up. I don't know.
I want to know your honest feeling. You've been through a bunch of these things. What are you feeling right now?
I am distressed and, frankly, a little depressed. As you said, I've been involved in a number of presidential and other campaigns. I follow them very closely. I teach it. And it's always a certain level of excitement and interest. And however weird these things have tended to get along the way, there was always a level of decorum, mm-hmm. Of discussion of issues, at least at some level. Mm-hmm. And I think we have lost all of that. This is a distressing time for I think all of us right now.
Were you surprised with how much attention the Trump tape has gotten since it was published by the Washington Post?
Well, yes and no, I guess. Yes, in that it is in some ways the most salacious, in that it was an actual tape of this guy talking about this stuff in ways that were just completely appalling. But in other ways, this is just a continuation of what we've seen from this guy all along. I mean, every step of the way, he has opened up new low points, I guess is what I want to mm-hmm. say, in political discourse. And this is just another one. I guess what I wonder about is why it took some of these folks so long to recognize this, people in the Republican Party to sort of recognize this and say, okay, what made this the one step too far, I guess, is the question that lingers with me.
Well, you've counseled people running for the presidency before. What do you think, first of all, what do you think of Donald Trump's strategy of focusing on Bill Clinton's past transgressions? And secondly, what did you think of Hillary Clinton's strategy of being more passive than usual and not responding to Donald Trump's attacks?
I didn't understand and still don't understand, and from what we've seen, I think most of us are there, what the point of Trump going into Bill Clinton's past was. Again, I think that's just another example of his misogyny. I think blaming Hillary Clinton for the wayward moves of Bill Clinton just smacks of a sort of sexism that we're actually not that used to seeing in presidential politics. You know, if what Trump is trying to do is reinforce his base, then I suppose it did help him. But that's not going to win him the presidency. We know where his base is. His base isn't going to move. So, you know, what was the point of getting them fired up again? It doesn't do anything with broadening that base. With Clinton, her reaction, I actually think her reaction was exactly right. I was afraid with her penchant for sort of getting into the weeds on things that she might do that with this issue. And I think she handled it exactly right. I'm just not going there with you. So I think her handling was appropriate. A difficult place to be, no question about it, but I think there was no place else for her to be.
Mm-hmm. How serious is the fact that some GOP lawmakers are backing away from Trump?
Well, I think for them it's very significant. You've got Senate candidates who have just sort of come to the point where they say, look, it's not in my best interest to be anywhere near this guy. I was up in New Hampshire this weekend, and so I was sort of inundated by not only the presidential campaign, but the Senate race up there. And Senator Kelly Ayotte finally said, I'm not supporting this guy. Of course, this came about a week after, in a debate, she said that she would recommend Donald Trump as a role model for her kids.
Yeah.
So she's in kind of a tough spot. Yeah. But I think that there are a number of races around the country where the Republican nominees are for senators saying, I just got to get away from this guy. This is not going to help. But there is the other side of that, which is, and I think Ayotte faces this as well as others, there are Trump supporters there who are not going to be happy with the fact that these folks are moving away. So they're really between a rock and a hard place. As far as Trump is concerned, it doesn't have any impact. In fact, it maybe have a positive impact on that base, those folks who have already committed to him and are going to get out and vote for him. But I don't see that it does anything, once again, for broadening his base. And that's why I think we are hearing the death knell right now. We're dealing with what they call the stench of defeat in the campaign, because none of this makes any sense in terms of what a presidential candidate has to do to win in the general election.
Greg, I know they're saying they're stepping back from Trump, but they're also saying they'll probably still vote for him.
Yeah.
Now, what sense is there in that?
Well, I think that's that hair that they're trying to split. They have to find a way somehow to accommodate those folks who are just have been appalled or are finally appalled at the stuff that this guy says and does, while somehow trying to figure out how to hang on to at least some of those Trump supporters in their states so that they can somehow pick up some of those votes. They're trying to have it both ways.
Yeah.
And this is a really, really awkward position for any candidate to be in. But this is what they're trying to do. And it's particularly obvious, I think, in the Senate, because those Senate races are so close. The Senate is likely up for grabs. So they're really feeling the heat here.
So what happens to courage and integrity?
Yeah, it's the question, isn't it? That really is, I think, what this come down to. And I think this is the appalling part of this process, because I think we as Americans, and, you know, I love talking about strategy as much as anybody, but this has gone beyond this. This is a moral issue now for this country. I'm looking desperately to see some of these folks take a stand based on these moral issues.
Right.
You know, we listen to Republicans who are backing down. Even the ones who are backing down are saying, well, I'm backing down because I have daughters. Well, what if you didn't have have daughters.
Right.
What's the difference? Almost to the person, they're saying, well, you know, I have daughters, and so this is a problem for me. And I don't, again, this is moral hair splitting that doesn't make any sense. I'm not seeing a lot of profiles encouraged in this process.
Right. Is there a mechanism for the Republican Party replacing their candidate at this late stage in the game? And if there is, who would they replace him with?
Theoretically, there is, because once the convention is out of session, the national party becomes a sort of committee of the whole of the convention. The convention is the is really technically the governing body of the party. But once it's in that almost 3 year and 11 month gap in between, it is the party. So it is possible that it could happen. But we have two problems. One is that in many states, ballots are already printed, and in some and in an increasing number of states, people are already voting. And it's my understanding that once a ballot is printed, the ballot is printed. The states would not go back and reprint their ballots if there were a change at this late date. And again, they have that problem that people are casting votes even as we speak in an increasing number of states every day. So theoretically, it's possible, but the likelihood of it working is pretty close to zero. And I think that to a large extent, I think the Republican leadership has come to grips with the fact that they're going to lose this one. Mm-hmm. So what's the point? The other, and who would they replace him with? Mike Pence would be the most logical one, I guess, to replace him with as the vice presidential nominee. But beyond that, I don't know who would touch this thing. I don't know who would want to take this over and go to certain defeat at this point. I can't imagine.
You know, Greg, polls have been strong for the Clinton campaign. Do you think it's likely things will continue in this direction, or are we going to go through another period before Election Day in which it all tightens again? Are there still surprises that could significantly shake up the race at the late date?
I think there's always room for surprises, but I think that as we look at the aggregate of these polls, I mean, the trend is not good for Republicans and for Trump. I was looking at the aggregate stuff this morning, and I don't think there's any of the states that we're really concerned about that haven't been moving toward Clinton. And a lot of these polls were completed before, or half of the poll was done before this weekend's events with these statements by Donald Trump. So the numbers are moving definitely in Clinton's direction. I think we will see some peeling off of support for Trump, particularly among women. I was reading some interesting stuff about women in the evangelical community who have been Trump supporters who are very unhappy with the situation. Not moving to Clinton, but I'd say moving to not voting or voting for one of the third-party candidates. So, as I said, always possibility for some surprises, but it looks like those surprises are probably going to continue to be in the direction in Trump's area. There are purportedly more stories about his behavior coming out, and his behavior in itself, I think, is creating a situation where they're getting into a downward spiral.
Greg, regardless of the outcome of this presidential race, I see the nation and our democracy as being terribly damaged by this campaign, particularly if Clinton wins. There will be millions of outraged, hate-filled, trust-no-one Trump supporters who truly believe that she belongs in jail. So what kind of healing will even be possible under these circumstances?
That is the important long-term question. We've got Donald Trump and to some extent Mike Pence basically telling their people that this is going to be a rigged election. Trump telling his folks that once you vote, go to some of those places, in quotes, to keep an eye on voting. And I think we know what he means by those places. I think these are places where there are large numbers of minorities voting. And I think that this kind of incredible cynicism, criminal cynicism, leaves us as a country terribly, terribly divided. I mean, to listen to that debate on Sunday and listen to one presidential candidate indicate that he intended to see his opponent in jail is something that goes so far beyond anything we've seen in American politics that it's a scary thought. I think that we're going to be much worse off as a nation as a result of this process.
Okay, here's a bonus question. Do you think WikiLeaks is working for the Kremlin?
It's hard to imagine that there's not some sort of connection there. Just the way these things have been playing out, there does seem to be a connection between WikiLeaks and the Kremlin. So yeah, I think there is. I think we will see that there is a connection, and this stuff is feeding itself into the news cycle. And there are some people who are questioning whether in fact there is someone connected in some way to the Trump campaign that's benefiting from this, and we know that some of his folks, some of his advisors, have worked very closely with some of these bad actors in Russia for mm-hmm. For and the former Soviet Union for some time. So there's some credibility to that claim.
Greg LaBelle is Assistant Professor of Political Management at George Washington University, where he runs the Semester in Washington Politics and Native American Political Leadership Programs. Greg is also a veteran of several presidential campaigns. Greg, this is such a tough election to make any sense of, and I have to admit that I have ask you questions that I never thought I would ask anybody related to an election in the United States. And that makes me more appreciative than ever for you helping us to understand and deal with what's going on. Thank you for being a faithful contributor to State of Belief Radio.
Well, they're important questions, Welton, and let's hope we never have to ask them again, huh?
That's exactly right. A lot has been said and written about Donald Trump's performance at the second presidential debate. His body language toward his opponent, his sneering dismissal of her pain at the hands of an unfaithful husband, focusing instead on her alleged attacks on Bill Clinton's accusers. Among all the commentary, I was struck by the articulate way New York Magazine writer Rebecca Traister got to the heart of what made so many viewers so uncomfortable Sunday night. She did so in a thoughtful New York article, as well as on the MSNBC program All In with Chris Hayes. And I am happy that she was able to join us on State of Belief Radio. Rebecca, I know your time is tight, but thanks for being with us today.
Thanks for having me here.
You see sexism as an integral part of Trump's carefully crafted persona. Is that an accurate statement?
That's absolutely an accurate statement. It was always part of his persona as a celebrity. You know, even before he began to be a reality TV show star on The Apprentice, he spoke in interviews, whether with Howard Stern or in the magazine press, about his attitudes within his own marriage, about how women should do all the work of raising the children, how he wrote in his books about how it was dangerous to send a wife to work in terms of Ivana, his first wife. Work within his company and how that sort of ruined her as a wife. He spoke all the time, again, simply as a New York celebrity and a businessman, about women as pigs and dogs and evaluated them on aesthetic and sexual scales, made very clear that his view of women was one in which their value was largely ornamental, was largely a reflection of his own male prowess. He certainly has never spoken about women as full human beings with a full set of ambitions, desires, priorities, or as worthy of his full and equal respect. He's never spoken about them that way. What's been interesting, in fact, is that he hasn't tempered any of that language as a presidential candidate. He's, in fact, emphasized and doubled down on a lot of it.
So how does all of that translate into the way that we saw him treat Hillary Clinton in St. Louis?
Well, his interactions with Clinton have grown more and more aggressive. I think if you just look at the contrast between the first debate and the second, you know, the first debate, he was aggressive and he sort of shouted at her and kept interrupting her and made a lot of faces. But it was after that debate when sort of everybody, I think in the media and certainly the polls reflected that everybody believed that she'd really beaten him.
Mm-hmm.
And for a man who has so effectively conveyed his view of male superiority over the years, to be beaten in such a big public contest by a woman, which, of course, this is a historic race. We have never been in a position where we've seen a woman mm-hmm. trounce someone on a presidential debate stage before, because we've never seen a major party nominate a woman for the presidency before. So this is new for everyone. And so this man who has spoken so openly about his patriarchal belief system and the way in which he sees women, to be beaten by a female opponent, I think enraged him mm-hmm. in a way that is very specific to when gender power assumptions are upturned. And in the second debate, and especially after the release of this tape, which sort of just further emphasizes his view of women as objects for his use and at his disposal, he went in with such aggression toward Clinton. The way he followed her around the stage and sort of stood just behind her shoulder, it was very threatening to watch. He narrowed his eyes, and his tone of voice, instead of that sort of loud shouting, was much more menacing. You know, the clip where he says, "You'd be in jail," mm-hmm. in this very dark, low, serious voice. The fact that he chose to bring in a group of women who had complaints about this candidate's mm-hmm. husband's past sexual misdeeds, and to bring those women into the debate hall mm-hmm. showed that he was looking to humiliate her. Donald Trump is not interested in the feminist argument about Bill Clinton's sexual misdeeds. He's on record. He's on tape. He's at the time that women were bringing allegations against Bill Clinton, Donald Trump is on record saying that those women are, the group of them, including some of the ones he brought into the debate hall on Sunday night, are terrible people, are unattractive. He said those things about mm-hmm. Paula Jones, about Juanita Broderick, the very women who he's now holding up as some sort of feminist argument against Hillary Clinton. Now, something that I have written and said before, which is that there is, of course, a feminist conversation to be had.
Mm-hmm.
And this country has been having it in various ways for many decades about Bill Clinton and the allegations that have been brought up against him in the past.
Mm-hmm.
There is absolutely a feminist critique of Bill Clinton and, in fact, more broadly, of the behaviors of all kinds of men who have held outsized public and political power and have exercised outsized sexual power in possibly abusive ways. But Donald Trump, who called these particular women have been terrible people in the past,
mm-hmm.
who on Friday was revealed to have talked about grabbing women against their will and assaulting them sexually, is certainly not the person who is interested in launching that feminist critique. Donald Trump is not a feminist.
Right.
He is using, in fact, the notion of feminist complaint and feminist critique of power imbalance as his excuse to humiliate the woman who's beating him for the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Bringing those women in was meant to shame his opponent for the American presidency, to make her feel bad about herself, to remind America that her husband cheated on her, which I think in Donald Trump's view, which he's made amply clear, that women's value is as sexual objects and to be sexually appealing to men, I think he must view a woman who he views as not holding her husband's sexual attention, that might be one of the worst things you can say about her,
mm-hmm.
and that's what he was trying to reemphasize to the American public. This was not a move on behalf of feminism. This was a deeply misogynistic set of choices that Donald Trump made in an effort to destabilize the woman who is beating him for the presidency.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. A key defense of the 2005 tape where the future candidate's talking with Billy Bush is, that was a long time ago, and it was, quote, locker room talk. Would mm-hmm. you explain how what we saw Sunday night is actually directly connected to the words on that Access Hollywood tape?
Well, I think that what we saw Sunday night is directly connected to the way that Donald Trump has been talking about women throughout this campaign.
Mm-hmm.
On Sunday night, the degree to which he was threatening control over Hillary Clinton's being, that he was, for example, talking about how he would go outside of what is of American law to have her prosecuted and jailed, mm-hmm. should he win the presidency and defeat her, that he kept threatening her with incarceration, that he wanted to sexually humiliate her, that the way that he was moving with so much physical aggression around her, behind her, making terrible, hateful faces at her, mm-hmm. that all conveyed much of the same aggression toward women that that tape conveyed, but it's all over his campaign in 2016. Talk about the fact that he has referred to Megyn Kelly as a bimbo,
mm-hmm.
that just 2 weeks ago after the first debate, when Hillary Clinton presented also sort of years-old evidence that he had been terrible to Alicia Machado, one of the Miss Universe winners, instead of distancing himself from the language that evaluated her based on her weight, he called into a morning show the next morning, just within the past 2 weeks,
yeah.
and continued to describe a beautiful woman's weight gain as very problematic.
Mm-hmm.
That is all of the same sort of thing that Donald Trump was saying. In that tape, he's using language that is more foul than he has used at other times, language that is more degrading. And he is more explicitly describing an act that we understand to be illegal, sexual assault. But the basic premise of what he's talking about, his power over women, is absolutely in line with language he has used consistently throughout his career and throughout this campaign, and with the way that he behaved toward Hillary Clinton on Sunday night during the debate.
Rebecca, can Trump's supporters just not see what's going on here, or do you think that at least for some of them, it's actually a selling point to see him act this way?
Yes, it's a major selling point. I think that Trump's sexism, as with his racism, which has been very open, you know, his willingness to call immigrants uniquely criminal, his reference to Mexicans as rapists, his descriptions of African-American communities as hellscapes, you know, he has trafficked in tremendous racism and xenophobia along with the sexism. And I think one of the things that we have to begin to reckon with in this country is that those approaches are features. They are not bugs. They are part of what his support is built on.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that we have to reckon with about the history and nature of this country is that it was built quite literally on the subjugation of certain groups of people, on African Americans who were enslaved, on women who were disenfranchised and whose domestic and familial subservience was part of what white male power was built on. And one of the things that's happened over the past century is that those power structures have begun to be upturned. And there's a tremendous resistance to the increasing power of women and people of color in this country. And, of course, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama stand in symbolically as these two individuals, but who carry a lot of symbolic weight as the first black president and the person who hopes to be the first female president. They are carrying the symbolism of the increased power of women and people of color in this country. And a good proportion of this country does not want to see the power structures changed, does not want to see people who used to not have power gain power, does not want to see a sacrifice of what used to be a pretty exclusive grip on power held by white men. And Donald Trump is channeling that resentment and that resistance to this change. And so, yes, for Donald Trump, talking about women as sexual objects who are there for his use, talking about immigrants as criminals, beginning his campaign on the fundamentally racist lie of birtherism and the notion that Barack Obama's historic presidency, whatever you may think about it, is illegitimate, that is what has drawn some large proportion of his supporters to him. This is why he's not apologizing. He knows that it is his appeal. He is channeling a resistance in this country to the kinds of movements by groups of people who used to be subsidiary and are increasing the amount of power that they have publicly, economically, socially, politically.
With women making up more than half the electorate, is there even a chance that this kind of behavior on his part could possibly result in success at the ballot box?
Well, based on current polling, it seems unlikely that he's going to have success at the ballot box. But it is a bet that he is willing to take because he's getting a huge amount of support from men. There are women. I think increasingly we're beginning to see some evidence that Republican women are peeling away from him. But there are always going to be women who support the kinds of ideas, even if it's not in their own direct best interest, mm-hmm. who support the patriarchy. That's always been a function of the patriarchy, is that you have women who support and defend it. White women historically have voted Republican. Married women have voted Republican. And you're still going to see women voting for Donald Trump. But I do think the margins are going to be much worse for him with women than they have been for previous Republican candidates. And I think you're going to see historic numbers of women peeling away from him. But that's all just a guess right now. We don't know. This is one of the things that I want to emphasize about what we're seeing right now, is that there's no previous model. We don't know what's going to happen over the next few weeks. We just don't know.
Rebecca Traister is writer-at-large for New York Magazine and The Cut, as well as contributing editor for Elle. She's the author of two important books titled Big Girls Don't Cry, The Election That Changed Everything for American Women, and All the Single Ladies, Unmarried Women, and the Rise of an Independent Nation, which came out earlier this year. We'll link to her article, Trump's One Service Was Exposing the Misogyny of the GOP, from thestateofbelief.com. Rebecca, I can't tell you how much I appreciate your voice and presence in the public media, because you're carrying a message that is absolutely essential, not only for our democracy, but for our morality. And I thank you for doing that in the broad sphere of things, but I also am very grateful that you'd take time to be with us on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I've enjoyed the conversation.
Before we go, a few words I want to share with you. Last Friday evening, I sat glued to the television set until early the next morning, listening to bipartisan condemnations sparked by the video of Donald Trump's comments on his perverse and misogynist view of women. It was eerie, to tell you the truth, the kind of conversation I never expected to be associated with a presidential election. But of course, this presidential campaign has been like no other I have experienced. The debate last Sunday evening served only to disturb me more and make me question what's happening in our nation. Television debates were incorporated into presidential campaigns in order to give the public more time and access to evaluate candidates and their policies. That's not what happened this past weekend. We saw an angry man, unable to be honest about himself and his campaign, try to eviscerate a woman by attacking her husband and seeking to prove that she is a bigger and bolder non-truth teller than he and should be put in jail, a fate that Trump would impose on her if elected president of the United States. Everything dirty, nasty, manipulative, and worse that has ever been cynically associated with politics was in full display during that debate, as it is every day on the campaign trail. I worried about the conclusions related to politics that would lodge in the mind of my 14-year-old grandson, who was watching the debate with his dad. My mind raced back to the Watergate hearings in 1973. U.S. Senator Joseph Montoya asked Gordon Strachan the liaison between the Nixon campaign and the White House, what advice he would give to young people interested in working in the political and governmental arena? Stay away, Strachan said forcefully. My fear is that message is being more subtly conveyed in this year's presidential campaign, and we just may be discouraging a whole generation of young people to stay out of politics. Not only is Donald Trump giving politics a bad name, he is sowing the seeds of suspicion and encouraging negations of democracy itself. Repeatedly, Trump speaks of a rigged election that could cost him victory on Election Day. What in the world is he doing? I don't remember another presidential candidate that has tried so blatantly to undermine trust in the nature of our government. Now, pivot has been as much of an overused term in this campaign cycle as it has been a strategy among candidates from the time of the primaries to the present moment. Pivot. Having said that, I now want to pivot. And I hope you're sitting down while listening, because I want to say a few words in defense of Donald J. Trump. Of course, such words are not needed among his avid supporters, so I will defend them as well as Trump himself. Now, there's a backdrop to my comments, and it's important. I'm remembering a story about a golden calf. It appears in the ancient Hebrew scriptures. While Moses, who was the leader of the Hebrew people, was out of the camp and up on a mountain seeking God's direction, the people in the camp grew impatient and decided they would make a god of their own liking and shape that self-fashioned god as their sovereign. Now, here's the defense. Donald Trump has every reason in the world to believe that he can and in fact should be president of the United States. For his entire life, Trump has lived in a country that worships wealth and power. Our culture of celebrity thrives in such a nation. Our electoral system is defined by it. Our judicial system reinforces it. Our criminal justice system perpetrates it. And to the extent that you and I and every other well-meaning American has turned a blind eye to this idolatry, this worship of money and power, this normalization of a double standard that affirms the greater value of some lives over others, we've been complicit in creating Donald Trump. In his interactions with his supporters, Trump channels perfectly the most successful demagogues in history. In his interactions with the media, he has, until recently, been received with limitless and almost universally uncritical coverage. Notice how, when actually challenged in an interview or a debate, the candidate is not only defensive and angry, he seems genuinely shocked. And why shouldn't he be? For a lifetime, Donald Trump has been building himself up to be what the culture around him has told him he should be, what he has to be in order to be the best by the standards we have allowed to define us. Criticism and disapproval shock him because, based on the world we have created, Donald J. Trump should not have to struggle to become president if he wants to. He's entitled to be president. In fact, he's entitled to be God, because that's the definition of idolatry. And Trump personifies everything that we have come to worship. In recent days, even as some conservative politicians strategically renounce the candidate. Prominent leaders of the political religious right have been twisting their rhetoric into pretzels to strategically defend this man. Powerful figures who reach audiences of many millions, from Pat Robertson to Franklin Graham to Tony Perkins and many others, have invented ingenious ways to erase their own past statements and defend Trump in ways so disingenuous that they perfectly mirror the golden calf itself. Trump is God's candidate, they've told us, while dancing around the self-serving God. In their worship of money and power, they exalt a God who is not God and was not God in their past. I've also heard quieter voices of faith begin to call for a prayerful, thoughtful, humble reevaluation of what we've become. I've seen the question asked, what is God showing us through this election? What, if anything, is there for us to learn amid this chaotic mess? These are fair questions, don't you think? But I don't think we needed to wait until it got to this point to hear the voice of God or good. All of the world's great religions are in remarkable agreement on the issues of money and power, on greed and injustice and blindness to the suffering of others. And make no mistake, for a vast number of Trump's followers, too many years of being on the receiving end of these sins at the hands of the rich and powerful is precisely what's led to their being ready to suspend belief and accept that this quickly shaped God finally is on their side. So they trust that the God they have shaped with their own hands can fulfill their hope. Obviously, they need their self-constructed God rather than any transcendent deity. They are hungry, ravenously hungry, to win an election at any cost and be great. Now, look, I don't know how or where we go from here, back to the way it was or forward to a better day. I don't know how we can visit again a time away from seeing each other as malevolent enemies, our lives as circumscribed by the whims of the rich and powerful whom we have allowed to become our idols. But I know that we have to find that place and that time again. Donald J. Trump may be rich and powerful, but I don't think he's particularly wise. And that's why he seems so surprised at any challenge to his birthright, no matter how slight. In more ways than is comfortable to admit, he is the president America deserves. Look, friends, we've not had a revolution or experienced an overthrow of our government. Trump defeated more than a dozen competitors to secure the Republican nomination for the presidency. The Democrats chose Hillary Clinton as their candidate from among five or six other contenders. Through our democratic process, we chose the nominees for this campaign. Trump won the nomination fairly. He is the president that a sizable block of people in this nation want, and that others of us passively made way for his rise in fame. As we wait for the final weeks of the election to play out, I hope a moment will arrive when we recommit to truly understanding and fearlessly defending the potential of this great nation to be more than just the playground of a few opportunists. Vote for the person whom you support, but please do not let them and their agenda be your God. Change is always possible. I support an election centered on change. But I hope the change comes before Election Day. I wish it were today, a day when we set aside self-made idols meant to make us rich and powerful and turn again to protecting a nation that covets freedom for religion and no religion in the cause of securing again a government of, by, and for the people that is irreversibly committed to freedom and justice for all. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. You help keep us going. That's important. If you've heard something on this week's show that you think would be helpful to someone you know, please share it with them. Direct them to stateofbelief.com, where they'll find full episodes, an in-depth archive, extended interviews, transcripts, and links mentioned in the show. The community that has grown around State of Belief Radio is active all week long, online. You can be a part of that. Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter and be a part of the discussion. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to tune in next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was. Mm-hmm.